And good morning once again, and welcome to the other side of midnight, that kind of magic time between dusk and dawn, where the things that we look at in daytime, we take a second look at after the sun goes down, because they're seen, well, I guess they're seen in a different light. Well, I could pretend nothing was going on, and we were going to have just a normal kind of run-of-the-mill open hailing frequencies tonight, but that is not the case. Before we get into some things of substance, let me do a couple of things at the top here. This is a remarkable week in terms of symbolic foreshadowing. Last night, my old friend Arthur Clarke's film, Childhood's End, the novel made into a film in Hollywood with a three-night miniseries on Sci-Fi, finally hit the airwaves. And please don't tell me anything, because I'm taping so that Robin and I can sit down and watch it all the way through. There's been kind of a bit of a distraction this week, so it would have been kind of hard to focus. So, you know, thank goodness for digital recording technology where you can record it and record it and record it and watch on your own time. Which, of course, brings me to the whole concept of Club 19.5, which I'll get to in a moment. If you go to othersideofmidnight.com and click on the upper right-hand corner, Radio with Pictures, that takes you to tonight's show page, item number one. The second event that happened this week, simultaneous, in essence, with Arthur's fabled classic coming to television and film for the first time, Star Wars, The Force Awakens. Advanced ticket sales have now exceeded $100 million. The Force Awakens. The Hollywood premiere was held last night, on Monday. The rollout across the country begins on Thursday with a full theater presentation starting on Friday. Big weekend coming up for Star Wars. It's eerie to think back that the first one of these, you know, George Lucas doing his thing, 1977. The fact that there's some kind of resonance here, that these two film projects, you know, hit the big screen the same week, again, you know, without being overly metaphysical, there's a tremor in the force here. There's definitely a resonance, because if you have heard any of our panels on Pluto and Ceres and Mars that I've been conducting with our imaging group over the last several months, you kind of got the hang of it by now that we're looking at Star Wars in our own backyard for real. Something awful, something tragic, something apocalyptic, something that makes all of the current pronouncements of Armageddon pale by any rational comparison, swept through the solar system a long time ago and left ruins, astonishing, stunning ruins in every direction. And the most exquisite and the most preserved of these ruins are now visible if you go to a few nights ago when we did the Pluto panel and you click on those images and you click on the links that people like Keith Laney have put up, the Hidden Mission links, the Rime of the Celestial Mariner. Part 2 is particularly important. Just go to that page and just begin to scroll down and look carefully. Look very carefully. There is architecture there. And that, of course, changes everything. It's going to be interesting to see how long it takes for the mainstream to kind of catch up to what's going on. That's part of the conversation I'm going to have with an old colleague and friend of mine in a few minutes, as I think there are other events moving that are being completely eclipsed and ignored by the mainstream press because they're being so elegantly distracted. And we'll get into that momentarily. If you go to link number three, well, actually, you could go to link number two on Radio with Pictures tonight. That's the story, major news story, on the latest Pluto close-ups released by Alan Stern. If you go to link number three and actually click on it, that is the one of the latest images. I mean, click on that and just look at it in close-up. That is a portion of this so-called Sputnik Planum, the plane of Sputnik, this heart-shaped whitish area in the center of the hemisphere that the New Horizons mission flew by within something like 7,000 miles back in July of this year, July 14th. Oh, God, It seems both so recent and so far away, events are accelerating at such an extraordinary pace. But if you look at this image really in close-up, and the best way to do it is to take it into some, you know, imaging program and kind of tool around and look at it, there's a whole lot of stunning geometry down there that the mainstream folks, Stern and companions and NASA and all that, are completely ignoring, because they haven't got a good answer. They can't yet tell us the truth, what it is. It's obviously geometry. It's obviously structural geometry. It's obviously the kind of geometry that Bob Harrison has been seeing on the other side of Pluto as we approached, and he has written up in his two very exquisite web pieces over on Sidonia Quest. And you can find those again by going back and looking through the links and the various bios on the last time we did a show, which was, what, Saturday morning we did another Pluto show. So all the links to all the participants' websites and their analyses are listed there. So just go back and click back a couple of days and you will find it. This image is just so extraordinary because, again, it shows us that the geology, the analysis being brought by the mainstream, by NASA, to these images is just totally, totally, totally left of the mark. And what they're doing is they're giving us these uncensored images so that we ourselves can arrive at a consensus as the politics behind the scenes build to what now has got to be inevitable, and the only thing in doubt is the date. When is the official announcement going to be made that, in fact, there's stuff out there that's not our stuff, that's someone else's, and life does change? Well, on that note, let me introduce my guest this morning, my surprise guest. Let me get to the right link here and go back to where I'm looking at things. Greg Ahrens. We don't have a bio up. We don't have anything because Greg is one of those people that has kind of always been there. I want everyone on othersideofmidnight.com radio with pictures to click on link number 4. That's the important link. What Greg and I have been doing, Greg lives in Minnesota, in Missouri, outside St. Louis. He's been a part of our Facebook discussions for some time. He's kind of second in command over there on our Facebook page. We have something like 40,000, 50,000 followers. And over the last several years, we've been noticing an intriguing pattern that, in fact, White House appears to bring out these Christmas cards every year. And going back to at least 2011, and we haven't had time to go back and look and see if the pattern extends beyond that, there appears to be a kind of an interesting thematic message, a kind of a sub-rosa, subtextual message to these Christmas cards. So, Greg, without further ado, welcome to The Other Side of Midnight. What was your take on today's release from the White House of the 2015 White House Christmas card?
Hey, morning, Richard.
Good morning.
I got the card in the mail today, and my first impression was that it was it had an Egyptian feel to it, or you know, the ancient. There's a symbol for Sirius,
the bright star Sirius, Isis in the Egyptian tradition. Isn't that ironic? Isis in the Egyptian tradition.
Right. And of course, the the picture. If you look straight onto it, it looks. There's the White House in the front, and then the Washington Monument, the Jefferson Memorial, the Lincoln Memorial behind that, and then there's the Capitol Dome behind that, and then there's some snowflakes and some hills and stuff in the background. And of course, the picture you have on there has it folded open. The card folds open, and the White House has. It's white on the front, and then it's the north portico on both sides. But on the inside, it has the wreath over the portico. But anyway, there's a symbol that has the symbol for the star Sirius in ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs. It has an obelisk, a dome, and a five-pointed star. And it's you know, one version said that the obelisk represents the phallic symbol of Osiris, and the dome represents the mother, the womb, Isis, and then the star represents Horus. No, I guess that's it. Well, now this one doesn't have a star on it, but it has
a whole bunch of stars. They're called snowflakes over on the right-hand side. And they're above two dogs that, of course, would represent Sirius.
Dog star, yeah.
Yep, the dog star. No, this is so in keeping because, again, if this is kind of a quiet, secret, coded message that there are major events coming, it's in keeping with the other Christmas cards. Remember the one in 2011 where it was set in the library? It was a painting of unopened presents on the library table. And there were the books on both sides of the fireplace, and there was this amazing reflection from the window on the upper right that turned out not to be a reflection. It turned out to be a double hexagon, a six-sided, star representing the double tetrahedron in the apparent reflections from the glass on the right-hand window, and on and on. I mean, this White House has done these incredibly multi-leveled symbolic cards. I really do think your decoding of this year's card is accurate. I think it does represent Sirius / Isis. And then, of course, you have the dichotomy. You know, the most hated terror group in the world right now is calling itself Isis. And then you have the classical tradition Isis represented by messages from this White House. Gosh, I wonder what the meta messages could be.
Yeah. And another thing I noticed about it was the monument, the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial, are draped with Christmas lights.
With decorations, yes.
On a strand, a strand of Christmas lights, but the lights are white and green.
Oh yeah.
So I was thinking that, well, I don't know. White, just the white light, the light, but the green light is, you know, in like Hollywood terms when they say they green lighted a movie,
very possible.
Or when you're, when you're driving and you get the green light, it means go. So I guess I'm thinking maybe this is something that they're maybe getting ready to green light
The thing that occurred to me is the backdrop to all of the events that have been going on in the political campaign, and of course we have to still get to tonight's Republican debate and the whole Trump, almost like a distraction. I mean, suppose there was a global effort, Greg, building toward the fabled D word, disclosure. And obviously, how would you handle this? You couldn't handle it with couriers. You couldn't handle it with, telexes. You couldn't handle it with email. Hillary's shown us that. The only way you could get leaders of all the major countries in the world all in one place so they could agree on the final terms of how to reveal to their people that, in fact, the human race is not alone in this pivotal year coming up. You'd have to get them all in the same room and then have to talk to each other where no one could overhear so they could all agree on timing and whatever. I'm beginning to wonder if this huge climate summit that's now been going on for weeks in Paris, Par-ISIS, the city named for ISIS, go back to Robert Bavall's work, and the terror attack before the climate summit in ISIS, basically you're looking at a meta conflict, a meta war between the end of the worlders represented by the terror group ISIS, and the people are going to try to resurrect the world represented by the other group under the codename ISIS, which goes back through the Egyptian, which goes back through the card symbology, which goes back to the climate summit meeting in the city of ISIS. And what are they talking about in addition to climate? I think they have been talking about how to announce to the world that we are not alone. This data, this stunning imaging information from NASA, from the Ceres mission, the Dawn mission, from the New Horizons mission, the Pluto mission, from the Curiosity mission, you know, running around on Mars and coming up to amazing artifacts and looking at them and sending back images from just a few inches away, all of this has got to be building toward someone, somewhere, at some point, saying, yes, everybody, this is real. This is what it looks like. History now changes. And isn't it curious, Greg, that there were 195 nations represented at the climate summit in Paris?
19.5.
These guys can't go down the hall to the men's room without doing it on a ritual date. Well, thank you, Greg. I think you've given us some things to think about.
Okay. Hey, Richard, just one other thing.
Sure.
I sent an email like last week, I guess, and you probably didn't get it, but I saw an article, a fellow a scientist working with out at Los Alamos, and he got all the old films of the nuclear blasts, all the tests that the United States did,
mm-hmm.
the original films on like acetate, and he's digitizing them, and so he's studying. And in the article, I'll resend you the link, but in the article, he says, we need to study this because they didn't always have the same yield that they were expected. And he thinks there was something in the, I think there's something in the physics that we're not understanding.
What a bright guy. By all means, send it to me, because both Joseph Farrell and I have actually worked on the fact, and Joseph has published extensively, and in his publications, he's quoted some of our conversations. Yeah, I think, and this goes back to, and I'm trying to think of the guy, he wrote the book, it was called, Something 33. He was a New Zealand airline pilot, and Harmonic 33, that was the name of his book. And I forget his name specifically, obviously somebody is going to Google, hint, hint, and send it to me in the Skype window. And I actually have an autographed copy of one of his books, so I'm really feeling embarrassed that I've forgotten his name. Anyway, this airline pilot years ago started tracking motions of UFOs, grid-type motions across the vast expanse of the South Pacific around New Zealand. And as an airline pilot, he was used to plotting, you know, grid directions and altitudes and latitudes and longitudes and all that. And he found there was this bizarre pattern. Well, long story short, the basis of that pattern, he felt, was a prediction where on Earth you could not detonate a nuclear weapon and have it explode. So I took a look at this early work, and I wish I could remember his name. Scott, you might want to go and, you know, Google for Harmonic 33. Bruce Cathay. Yes, that's it. Bruce Cathay. Thank you. Thank you. Anyway, I believe that what Bruce stumbled on was not a secret technology or mathematical inference where you can't detonate a nuclear weapon, but in fact, latitudes and longitudes and celestial angles in terms of the changing hyperdimensional / torsion field physics of the solar system, where when you do detonate a nuclear weapon, it will have more or lesser yield depending upon the background energies that the thermonuclear explosion is able to kind of suck into the event. So when you had these nuclear detonations, someone's making weird noises in the background. Please stop that. When you have these weird, you know, wildly varying yields from nuclear tests by Americans in the South Pacific during the 50s and 60s, Joseph believes, and I believe, that that's based on the different degree of the background field physics at the time of the nuclear explosion, meaning that Bruce Cathay was right in a weird kind of way, that latitudes, longitudes, and the changing physics of the system determines the yield when you bang off a thermonuclear device. That would be a stunning thing to pursue, and that's why, yes, please send me that link again, because if someone else has kind of realized that these variabilities in yield, based on simple physics of X amount of nuclear fuel, you know, you ignite it, you should get exactly the same result for the same amount of, you know, kilograms of active material, and they didn't. That says there's an X factor, there's an X force, there's something not modeled in current physics which can, I mean, we're talking wild changes in yield by thousands of kilotons, if not megatons, in some of the larger tests that they were carrying out. That's not trivial. That's indicating a way to tap into, and I hate this term, free energy on a consistent basis if you figure out what you're doing right and what you're doing wrong. So anyway, Greg, thank you for bringing that to our attention.
Okay, thanks, Richard. Good night.
Okay, night. Okay, I know everybody has been waiting very patiently to for me to get into the nubbin of the conversation. Remember, tonight is Open Hailing Frequencies. We will be taking calls on any subject of any anything that you feel of interest of the rest of the audience, of me, of this show. Our Skype information is, the number is 505-796-8802. That's 505-796-8802. Or our Skype handle is Enterprise Mission. So we got a few minutes before the bottom of the hour. So let me tackle the problem that's been with us ever since last Saturday morning. This network is going off the air. Dark Matter Radio Network is going off the air. And that means that this show, Other Side of Midnight, has to find another home. So in the last several days, across the weekend and yesterday and today and tomorrow and the next day, we are discussing with a lot of people who have suddenly come forth and offered us major possibilities for moving if Keith and I can't reach a kind of a modus vivendi. I'm getting information that Keith is now reconsidering his idea of going off the air. But the problem is that you can't build a radio show on uncertainty. When Art suddenly last Friday decided to quit, it caused an incredible cascade of negative repercussions, not the least of which is the financial, which is we're basically looking at how we could sustain the program here, and if that's not possible, how we can have a smooth transition to some other place, somewhere else. And a lot of people have come forward, and so we're actively looking at many other offers. The one thing I can say is that if Dark Matter cannot continue to be the home of this show, we'll put it somewhere else, and we've had some very nice offers. Major networks have come forward, major people in broadcasting who have been listening and observing and who have seen the stunning reaction of our audience. I mean, I really cannot express my appreciation too much for the quality and the sustainability and the loyalty of this audience. You folks have been tremendous, absolutely tremendous, and that's what's going to carry us through. I mean, at some level, at some large-scale level, we're probably conducting our own inadvertent consciousness experiment, because if all of you out there who've been writing the amazingly positive emails that you've been writing, you know, are thinking the same thing and in concert, then yes, this show is definitely going to be somewhere else. It will survive, it will prevail, and we will be able to carry on and continue and do what it is that we have been trying to do for the last 6 months. But again, in the face of serious uncertainties, you know, we have to look at backups, because the last thing I want to see is, because of something as stupid as money, this show does not have a chance to demonstrate what it is capable of. And given the fact that an awful lot of you have been writing very positive notes in terms of the mix and match of guests and topics and the way we approach talking to people and talking about various items and relating items that you might not think are connected, a la James Burke, to the idea that ultimately underneath at some level they are connected, I'd like to see that develop and continue and expand. I mean, the whole idea of radio with pictures, where we can take you to the edge of the solar system, and anywhere on this planet you can tap on screens and use your little finger pinch and expand out and look at details as we walk you through them. That's never been possible before to this degree in radio, and it's something that I also want to pursue and see whether it's efficacious in many other areas. So that's kind of where we are right now. Keith and I are working to take the show successfully to places it's never been before, but if that does not work, if the subscriptions don't increase rather dramatically, when Keith removed the temporary suspension on Friday or Saturday, I guess, the first day, 45, 50 people signed up, and it's been going up from there. I really am telling you that the more you demonstrate by joining Club 19.5 that you are sustaining members of this show, of this experiment. You know, all you people that used to listen to Art Bell, and of course now Art is no longer there to listen to live, if you want to shift your viewing hours to Other Side of Midnight, obviously that's one way to continue sustaining the network, and we will try to keep you entertained and intrigued with a intriguing variety of guests. I have another surprise for later in the week that's kind of cogent to some of the contemporary conversation going on out there. You might have heard a rumor that Stanley Kubrick came out in some form and admitted that he had faked the moon landings. Well, not exactly. And we're going to have a close-up and personal discussion of that in the next few days right here on the Other Side of Midnight. But the one thing that I can leave you with before the bottom of the hour is, if you want to see this show continue, if you want to see this network continue, now that the big box store Macy's or Sears has left the building, we need to fill in that gap. You know, Keith cannot do this out of pocket. It costs money. As you know, the bandwidth costs have been very large. We have apparently now found a much set of cheaper alternatives, which I'm very grateful, and the bandwidth might recede as a serious issue. But there are other sustaining costs, so we've got about 30 days to make a go of it here. Otherwise, the show will have to move somewhere else. Fortunately, there are people standing by in case we can't make a show of it here, but I'd love to really give it the old college try, and that goes back to the advantages of being a member of Club 19.5. Not the least of which is you do with that the way how I'm treating Childhood's End. You know, when you record something and then you can binge watch it, all three episodes, or you listen to our show and you want to maybe pick and choose from different guests and different nights when the topic was very interrelated and we refer to other guests and other programs so you can have a larger view of how this subject in all its complexities ultimately can be figured out. Well, that's kind of the philosophy of what I'm trying to do with the club, with Club 19.5. If you join the club, you can listen to us anytime, day or night. I have a lot of people who commute who say they tape us the night before and then they, pop that on in the car and they, their commute goes away because they're basically listening to conversation that they couldn't stay up and listen to live. So the more of you that join Club 19.5, the more we'll have an idea of whether this is going to work in its current incarnation and in its current home. What more can I say? I want to thank everyone who's also suggested that we might look at changing the price. I don't want to do that right away. I want to see if we can do this at the current price of $5 a month. That's, one cup of coffee at Starbucks, and basically, there you are. Okay, we're at the bottom of the hour. It's Wednesday night. Well, Wednesday night. It's Tuesday night, Wednesday morning. And this is Bobby Bright, our kind of alternate theme. You're on the Other Side of Midnight. My name's Richard C. Hoagland. And when we come back, we'll open the lines.
If you really listen hard, you can hear what the universe is saying. Time for you to wander through the mansions in your mind. Nothing to lose, there's everything to find.
What's up, brother?
The Other Side of Midnight is a new expedition into matters of scientific relevance. We explore the impact galactic revelations might have on both our societies and psyches. Join host Richard C. Hoagland as he takes you on a journey through the minds of scientific experts, investigators, entertainers, and analysts. Other Side of Midnight airs live for free Monday through Friday from midnight to 2 a.m. Pacific. For only $5 a month, listen to the show anytime. Join Club 19.5 to access our full show library of on-demand archives. Go to othersideofmidnight.com and click on the Club 19.5 logo to join today. The Other Side of Midnight, contrasting our own science fiction dreams with reality in this what we call the human experience.
And we are back on the Other Side of Midnight. I think we've got Torch on the line. You there?
Hey, Richard. How are you tonight?
Good morning. Well, I'm feeling a lot better than I did Saturday morning. Things are a little clearer. Keith and I are trying to work this out so that it actually works. But again, it all comes down to economics, and that comes down to sheer audience numbers. The more people we can put in the club, the more cash flow there is for the network, and the more likelihood that we can stay on the air here.
Well, we've always wanted you to have a three-hour show, right? Why don't you just slip into that slot and Heather can move into the two-hour slot behind you?
Well, for some reason, Keith doesn't want to move me into the 9 o'clock slot, and I can't understand it. He says, oh, you don't do a paranormal show, and I'm saying, I think you're kind of underestimating the audience. They don't want paranormal. They want truth. They don't want artificial labels. They want us to relate how all of this weird stuff. And if you don't think this mainstream presidential election is weird and is by any measure of any discussion paranormal, I mean, look again. So, yeah, we are trying to cover the waterfront, but Keith says that since I don't do a, quote, paranormal show, that he's going to keep Heather there at 9 o'clock, and the only thing that will change that is if a lot of you make it clear that you want our show and you want it at a more reasonable time. And remember, back east, it's still the other side of midnight.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I know. Believe me. I'm back east.
You're in Georgia, right?
No, I'm in Philly.
Oh, you're in Philly. Okay.
Yeah.
How did I get the impression you were? Oh, it's another guy. I think it's Patrick who's in Georgia. Anyway, so what did you call about?
The Stanley Kubrick thing. That was that was all fake. That was, if you noticed it, I don't know if you've watched it. But he refers to the guy who's actually playing Stanley Kubrick as Tom. four times he calls him Tom.
Well, but see, it's not so much that it's a fake. I mean, instantly we all knew it was a fake. The question is, why make a big deal out of the fake now? Who are they trying to convince desperately? I mean, to me, it reeks of desperation. So I call up a friend of mine who's been heavily involved in this research for some time. And depending upon schedules, he'll either be able to be with us tomorrow morning or hopefully the morning after, one of those two. So just kind of, you know, hang loose.
Yeah, well, I think they should move you into the three-hour slot, too.
Well, I'm willing to go to 9 o'clock and do 3 hours. I mean, preparing for this show is a little different than other shows because it's really you're doing a kind of a hidden quasi-television show at the same time. I mean, radio with pictures is not easy to put together. And if we had a little more time, we could maybe do it a little better. And I've got some folks I'm going to bring in from the outside who have some expertise that we don't have that can help us maybe refine it and give us video and other things that we don't currently have. So, yeah, I would like the 9 o'clock slot, but again, it's up to Keith.
Right. Well, it's better than folding, that's for sure.
Well, yes. I mean, we're here and we can stay here provided enough people join 19.5 to make it worthwhile for the network to continue to carry us.
Go ahead. What's the Harmonic 33 thing you were talking about?
Well, Bruce Cathy, who, as I said, was this New Zealand airline pilot back in the, the 80s, I guess, started looking at these grid point patterns for UFO sightings and being a navigator. You know, back in those days when you navigated a big airplane, a commercial airplane, they literally took star sites. They didn't have GPS. They didn't have satellites. They literally took a guy with a sextant and put him up in a bubble on the top of the airplane at night to shoot star sightings with angles and declinations and azimuths so that you could derive your position on the surface of the planet. So that navigation background in Cathy's, you know, commercial airline experience got him intrigued with the apparent patterns of these UFO sightings. And then that led him, you got to read the whole book because it's very complicated and I cannot explain it again, without diagrams and radio with pictures at all. But it ultimately led him to the idea that the UFO appearances were not random. They were being staged in a precise geometric fashion. Gosh, where have we heard the idea of geometry and extraterrestrial stuff linked together? And that led him to an alternate physics Where have we heard that one before? And then that led him to the idea that there were certain times where if you even tried, you couldn't detonate a nuclear weapon. And that led me, when I read all that, to think, wait a minute, maybe he's got only part of the answer in that it's not that you can't detonate, it's that the yield will be bigger or less than you calculate based on known physics. And lo and behold, Joseph Farrell and now this other guy that my friend Greg is going to send me the info on, he also is saying that there's something that changes the yield of a nuclear weapon, which, of course, is total heresy to current mainstream physics. I mean, that's getting us into alignments, celestial alignments, hyperdimensional equations, latitudes, longitudes, geometry. God, it's sounding like maybe nuclear physics is only a subset of a bigger physics, right?
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
Anyway, and you were talking pretty exciting stuff, because wouldn't it be funny if the U.S. and the USSR back in the old days had decided, you know, to declare war and then nothing happened because it was the wrong day and the wrong alignments and the wrong geometry?
Yeah. Well, when they did that test in Bikini, the Bikini Islands, they actually got a much larger yield than they thought they were going to.
Yes, and Farrell and I think it's because if you do it right at the right time, at the right time of day, and the right latitude and longitude on a planet spinning through the solar system, it changes the background gating. In other words, a nuclear weapon can literally be powerful enough to tear a hole in space-time, and depending upon what's behind the hole, which depends on the time and the latitude and longitude, the bang can be bigger or smaller than you calculated based on just three-dimensional mainstream physics, as is currently allowed to be known.
I got you.
Isn't that astonishing?
Yeah, man.
And
definitely.
Apparently now some other guy completely has kind of looked at this and looked at the pattern and says, whoa, there's something weird here. These explosions are not going off the way they should have. And a lot more people, a lot more scientists should look at this, because this is a stunning historical record of HD physics right in your face in action, if we're right.
Probably something to do with ley lines. Definitely.
Well, yeah, because it's the alignments and the grid patterns on the surface of the Earth, because you're looking at energy, you know, transmissions in the so-called ley lines, which are really interference points in a hyperdimensional grid, not just a spherical, but a hypersphere.
Right.
And that goes back to Stan Tenen and his work the other night. And see, I'm trying to build up with a pattern of shows and guests a gestalt to where when you go back through Club 195 and you listen to the old shows, you can listen to them connected in the right order, and then these relationships that I'm building in kind of as we go along can be yours right there, because you can pick the right other program elements to make it pop and make it go, oh, is that what it's supposed to be?
Right. Yeah, and one other thing, you were talking about something came through the solar system a few times.
I'm not sure.
Our solar system? I think there's a big planet that's coming through soon that's going to upset our solar system again, like it has before.
I know that's your perspective. I tend to differ with you, but we will see, won't we?
Yes, we will. Hopefully you're right.
You want to make a bet? I'm very good at winning these bets, okay?
I don't want to win this bet.
No, I don't think any of us. Please turn down your device. When I add you to the conversation, make sure your device can be turned down. Okay, George, was that it?
Yeah, no, one more thing. I've been looking at like ruins that they've been unearthing recently. And the geometry of these ruins are almost identical to what you're finding on Mars and Pluto and Ceres.
Isn't that special?
Yeah, man.
Isn't that special?
Looks identical.
Okay. All right. Well,
take care, Rich. I'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you much. Michael, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you, Richard?
Doing fine. Don't overmodulate.
My device. I want to shout out to the DM talkers and all your fans.
Go ahead.
And everyone there, this Wolfman, Mike. Anyways, I want to talk about, oh my gosh, I'm so nervous.
There's Rich. No reason to be nervous. It's just us and a few hundred thousand people.
Yeah.
Why should you be nervous?
Oh, I had such a great... Okay, it's about ancient weapons.
Ah, yes, one of my favorite subjects.
Okay.
See, Joseph, my friend Joseph Farrell, he thinks the Great Pyramid was built as an ancient weapon, as an ancient torsion field weapon. And I adamantly, categorically say, no, Joseph, you're wrong about that. It's much more interesting.
I think it's more positive.
I do, too.
I feel positive energy. I'm considered a wizard.
Oh.
By my own followers that recognize me as a wizard. Because I actually can exorcise evil spirits from houses so that children sleep at night.
Okay.
It's one of the things I do. And I'm also a musician. But what I was wondering was if, the ancient, in India, there's a place, I can't remember the name of it, but apparently it's been sealed and there's some kind of an ancient weapon. And I believe the United States may have, some of the wars they've started in the Middle Eastern countries may have been started as a result of looking for these ancient weapons.
You mean like the, I believe there's a city, an ancient city called Mohenjo-Daro?
I think that's it.
And now there have been rumors for years that when nuclear scientists have actually taken soil samples, that the radioactivity levels, the background radiation levels at Mohenjo-Daro are anomalous. And every time I try to go and get real data to confirm or deny that.
Have you tried to go there?
What you mean, physically go there?
Yes, physically.
No. Because, yes, it would be intriguing maybe to try to measure the torsion field there. But if someone banged off ancient nuclear weapons, it's probably not going to be very – it's not going to register on the equipment, on the technology that we bring to bear. So it's much more interesting to pursue this if you actually got radioactive samples, collected in the field at Mohenjo-Daro there in India, and took them to a laboratory and actually measured quantitatively the amount of radiation coming from, nuclear isotopes in the samples compared to normal background at various other places on the Earth. Unfortunately, when you try to go and research that, you always wind up with a dead end. It's almost like that's an area that we're not supposed to even kind of ask the question about.
I don't know who else to ask except you. Come on. It's Wolfman asking the okay. Come on.
Well, look,
you're one of my heroes, and I look up to you all the time, and you're one of my, every time when I get up in the morning, like, you're one of the people that make me think, hey, I can make a difference in the world, because I just listened to Richard C. Hoagland last night, and he just made me inspired me into thinking a whole.
Is that as good or better than sleeping at a Holiday Inn Express?
Well, anyway, Richard C., you're one of my heroes. So
was that it, Michael?
I got lots more for you, but if you want to let someone else
We got a bunch of other people, so let's give them a chance. Let me leave it this way. I'll ask Joseph again if he's got any really current, permanent, new data on this ancient nuclear war thing, or ancient war in general. Remember, John Brandenburg thinks there was a nuclear war on Mars after we talked about it decades ago.
There was ancient wars. We know there was ancient wars. I just want to know if you got some more goodies for us to let us know some current data, some of the goodies. Come on, Richard.
All right. We will do. Okay?
Okay.
Thank you much.
From the Wolfman. Love you, buddy.
Hey, Richard.
Yes, Scott.
Yeah, something the Torch mentioned at Bikini Atoll, they got a yield that they didn't expect when they were testing the hydrogen bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall a documentary about that giant super-duper bomb that the Soviet Union set off in, I think it was late 61. It was like a 50 megaton. It was the largest thing that's ever been exploded.
Yep, it was around 50 megatons, and it was somewhere in eastern Russia, I think.
Yeah, but when they were doing the analysis, if memory serves, they got way more bang for their buck or their ruble than they expected.
Well, this goes back to, if you blow these things off at the right place or the wrong place at the right time or the wrong time, do the equations totally change? Because there's an unacknowledged source of energy that the nuclear events are actually allowing to penetrate into this dimension and to show up as basically entropic heat. I think we have Paul with us on the line. Paul, you there?
Yeah, sure I am, Richard. How are you doing tonight, my friend?
Turn down your mic. You're a little bit hot.
Oh, sorry about that. Is that a little bit better?
Okay, much better, much better.
Anyways, how are you doing tonight, Richard?
Well, given the uncertainties around the show, I think I'm doing fairly well.
I have to admit, I think you are too. I wanted to call in and just really express my support and give a shout out to my buddies over on X. We're all listening every night you're on, and we absolutely love your show, love your infectious enthusiasm, and you really do need a third hour, bud. I'm dead serious about that, and I think there's a lot more people that listen that would like that third hour than you think.
If Keith can't move you to 9 o'clock because, you know, there's some deal with keeping Heather there for the next month, we can do the show from here, but we do need 3 hours, and that, again, is a function of money. If we get enough subscriptions, that means that Keith doesn't have to sit at the board himself and do board op and fall asleep, which has been known to sometimes happen. I'm not telling any tales out of school. But he could hire a board op, you know, just for those few hours, and we could have 3 hours even in our current time slot. So it's really down to a function of money, which is really down to a function of people who want to join Club 19.5 and all the benefits thereof. Now, did you have something else you wanted to ask or talk about?
Yeah, other than calling in, showing my support and the support of everybody that I listen with, I wanted to talk about Universal Constructors.
Oh, now that sounds intriguing. It almost sounds like something out of the Transformers.
Yes, I called in briefly to discuss it with Art Bell a couple of weeks back. He didn't really have much to say other than everybody he had spoken about Universal Constructors with were no longer speaking, so to speak.
Okay.
So I wanted to he was probably just, you know, shooting the, you know. But regardless of which, I think it's a very interesting topic, especially with – we're always hearing on the news now about how we're always like 10 years or 15 years away from fusion or fission, this. And I know you don't like the term the free energy. But what happens when we do get that energy? Like what would we really be using it for? I think very quickly we would turn towards destructive tendencies, because that just seems to be the nature of man at the moment. But I think it could be used to power something that philosophers and alchemists have been looking for hundreds of years. And that's the philosopher's stone, a universal constructor.
Again, Farrell has written extensively about this. I forget which book because it's so hard to keep track of all the books that he writes. But he's definitely written about this at some level. So,
oh, has he?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I just don't have offhand the, you know, which book that it's probably one that has alchemy in the title, because he has, and Philosopher's Stone. He's done an extensive kind of back engineering of the ancient claims and the ancient texts, and tried to translate the text into more scientific terms that would lead you in the direction of unusual properties of materials or unusual properties of energy, i.e., you know, tapping into the field. The most striking example is, of course, these nuclear weapons tests where, you know, it's basically like baking a cake. You know, you put X number of pounds of material together with X number of pounds of material. You bring them together very fast in microseconds, and they're supposed to detonate a nuclear explosion based on the number of atoms that have been disintegrated or fused in the samples brought together in the fission bomb, which is used as a trigger. The problem is that the yields for these weapons over the last 30, 40, 50 years, if you go back and look at all the test data, they're all over the map. it's kind of like there's this weird X factor. There's something else going on, so that some of the bombs almost fizzled, pun intended, mm-hmm. and others were dramatically more efficient. And that, again, speaks directly to the idea of an unseen, unmodeled energy source that the nuclear technology was triggering. And the only variables were latitude and longitude, and where the Earth was in the solar system compared to all the other stuff in the hyperdimensional model that says that those geometric relationships are critical in terms of modulating the background energy field up and down. Yeah. So there needs to be some really robust research because, see, the good news is that unless you are on the level of a government, assembling the technology to turn the field into a weapon is very, 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 very hard. Whereas turning the field into something that's useful as an energy technology for heating or communications or for light or for biological purposes where you extend people's lifetimes, you know, you cure diseases, that is so much easier to do because to make a weapon with this background field requires a lot of technology, and that's kind of expensive, and you're not going to get it at Radio Shack.
And I don't think you bring up an interesting point. You mentioned government, and you're right, because I don't think I think if you do move as big and you are as bloated and you do have so many clandestine agencies and DARPA money disappearing all over the place, it would be difficult to do this, which is why I think it's going to be private corporations. It's going to be private companies. And I would pay very close attention to Google and to Apple and to their acquisitions that I'm very sure are coming very soon of very large pharmaceutical companies. Because if we go back to, say, this universal constructor and the Philosopher's Stone, and you mention how a friend and a colleague of yours has written about it and it's ancient. Well, if it's an ancient technology or if it's an alien technology and it's a technology that has been possessed before, then it's something that we can discover again through science, through hypothesis, through attempts. If somebody else has created it, surely we can create it. And if they haven't created it, well, we already have within our imaginations, and the human mind is capable of, I think, inventing anything that it imagines, as the 20th and the 21st century has shown us.
I totally agree.
And on that note, Richard, I'll bid you a good evening. And once again, just your enthusiasm for these topics is infectious. You are infecting others. Please keep it up. I will continue to call in. Other great people will call in. God bless.
Thank you, Paul. Okay. Now, you are on the air. Where are you calling from, and who are you?
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, yeah, my name is Dave. I'm calling from New Jersey.
Hi, Dave.
Hi. It's great to talk to you. I can't believe you're on live with all the turmoil that's going on.
Well, I wanted to give everybody a kind of a status report where we are, and we're moving in the right place, at the right direction. And again, it all depends on this audience. If you demonstrate that you want this show on the air, it's going to stay on the air. If you don't, unfortunately, that's the way the business works.
Yes, I love the way you give your callers plenty of time to discuss whatever subjects they call in to talk about.
Well, I mean, think of callers, Dave, like I think of guests. I mean, you're a guest on this show, and everybody who calls in has a story. Everybody has a point of view. They got a story. They have a different angle on things. Their life experience is different. So everybody is a potential gem, a serendipitous gem, just waiting for the right time. Now, come on, knock us out, Dave. Tell me something I really have never heard before. Come on.
All right. I don't know if you have heard of this, I'm sure. Are you familiar with the Georgia Guidestones?
Yeah, sure. But that's a huge field to talk about, because obviously whoever paid for them, didn't they find out the other day that this guy Christian, the guy with the assumed name, actually was connected to some group?
There's rumors. There's so many rumors, you don't know who to give credence to. But I was wondering how you felt about the first commandment on the stones, like supposed to maintain the population under 500 million. I mean, there's like over 7 billion people on the planet now is the figure that you're always here. So you think there's like some sinister plans underway to reduce the population?
Well, I know that's been the kind of mystique around the Georgia Guidestones for years and years and years. It's a kind of a secret, coded veiled reference to the need to eliminate, you know, billions and billions of people, a la Kissinger, etc. I have a little different take, and that is that if we're limited to conventional technology, fossil fuels, oil, coal, the way that we did things in the 19th century, and we're still doing them all over the world in the 21st century, that will, if you have enough people, that will destroy the world. That will literally, if only by means of burning fossil fuels, you keep dumping the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and you warm up the background environment, ultimately, if you rise it, you know, 5-10 degrees, you have created an environment inhospitable for human beings, so you have destroyed the world.
Exactly.
If, however, you can equip 7 billion people with hyperdimensional torsion technologies, which produce energy without heating up the world, which produce energy without, you know, the side effects of carbon dioxide and excess water vapor, if you can make deserts bloom by providing electricity for pumps, massive pumping stations that could literally dump, you know, billions of gallons of desalinated seawater into the Sahara or other places where desperate need is for water and arable land that is no longer arable because of either man-made problems created like the Dust Bowl or because the environmental conditions just were never conducive to growing food. You can live lightly off the land, but you've got to bring in an alternate, radical, you know, type 2 civilization type technology, and that's where we are tonight. We're at loggerheads because the powers that be don't want to reveal that this physics exists and is real, yet at the same time they're encouraging more and more people on a limited planet where in a closed system there's ultimately a limit. So something's got to give.
And that's what I was going to ask you, if you felt that this technology has been suppressed by the in order to maintain the status quo.
Absolutely. And see, we can't go on much longer because we're now watching sea level rise. We're watching islands sink. We're watching areas of deforestation. We're watching the huge rainforests of South America just literally disappearing at the rate of thousands of acres per day, and that can't go on. So unless something different is introduced, a game changer, along with the revelation that the human race is not alone. See, this is what I think is quietly going on in Paris at these talks. I think they're preparing politically to tell us that history is going to change, because if they don't, then none of these treaties make any sense. They make no sense at all, because how could you have individual nations deciding whether they're going to comply when anyone who does not comply is basically accelerating the death knell of the entire human species through science, which is methodically and monotonously predictable. We know what's going to happen if this goes on, therefore it can't go on. The only question is, how is it going to change? It can either change catastrophically.
People are very short-sighted, and they're only concerned with the now.
Well, they are, but see, that's what leadership is supposed to be all about. You're supposed to actually do something more than just be concerned with the now. And we have reached the top of the hour, so why don't we take a pause? You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and let's hear a little bit of Clive Wright, the Queen of Sidonia. There are ruins out there, and they're getting closer and closer and closer. The ruins politically may be about to be born. They may be about to dawn on everybody's consciousness. And if that indeed does happen, if that's what's being quietly worked on behind the scenes, then it in fact will change the world, and it will change the world for the better. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
So did you hear what was talked about on the other side of midnight last night? You didn't. So you say it airs too late at night? Well, that's no problem. Certainly listening to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating roundtable discussions with guests and callers is an enjoyable time to be had for sure. But I understand it can be too late at night for most people. Well, never fear, the internet is here. Recordings of every show are available in the Other Side of Midnight archives through a low-price monthly subscription to the show. Visit othersideofmidnight.com and click on the sign-up link and listen to the shows anytime for a bargain price of only $5 a month. Then you can get your daily fix of cool out-of-this-world programs that only RCH can deliver. Don't take a chance of missing out on great, old-style, long-form discussions of topics you really need to hear about. That's othersideofmidnight.com. Sign up tonight before you fall asleep again.
And we are back on the other side of midnight on a very interesting and very cold in the land of enchantment Tuesday morning. I'm looking outside my window at the thermometer, and the thermometer is not looking back. It says it's 21 degrees. Very clear, very cold, 21 here in New Mexico. Anyway, we have a new caller on the line. Who are you and where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy.
How you doing? How you doing, Charles?
Doing fine.
I would like to piggyback on what one of the previous callers had mentioned about you getting on at 9 p.m., if we can talk about that.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I look at over the different social media areas, and I'm actually a member of BellGab myself, and you are definitely the person I know we all want at 9 p.m. I mean, there's an ongoing grassroots movement to get people to subscribe.
It's all up to Keith. Heather, I've never met Heather. I've never actually even heard Heather. I know Heather's not Art Bell, and based on the audience reaction to this show, I feel that we could probably have a better shot at retaining Art's listeners than someone who does not have the track record that Art or I've had. And you know, that's just the way. Radio is a very cruel business in some sense, because it ultimately depends on whether you are liked by thousands and thousands of people that you will never meet. I mean, the only way that we can meet is by means of our voices, how we communicate, whether we share resonances, whether we share things that we can agree on, or whether we can agree to respectfully disagree about stuff. And then, of course, there's the guests. I mean, I've even offered to take the guest list that Heather had booked for Art for the next month and just take, you know, start at the top of the list and go through. I have a feeling I could find interesting things about guests that other people might not, and vice versa. But at least, why don't we do the experiment, and then if it doesn't work, after a week or two, you know, Heather could come back, and I could come back to this time. But to me, I just have a feeling that we're being kind of artificially restrained, because this show cannot really grow unless we have 3 hours. Putting 3 hours here totally will overtax, you know, Keith working 24/7 as it is now. To me, the simple thing would be to move us to 9, but again, it's not in my hands.
Yeah, I just want to say there's like a grassroots movement between, like, you know, Slash X, DM Talk, Midnight Fans, trying to get people to subscribe. But, you know, it's like, if we're doing all this work, we definitely want you on it at 9 p.m. And I'll let everyone know to contact Keith as well.
He's the guy.
And having Art gone and you, I don't know, in flux and everything, we need you in 2016. It's like, I wrote a little, like, a poem. And it goes, oh, Hoagie, is Art going to sell us tomorrow? Oh, Hoagie, is Art going to sell us in Georgia? Yes, yes, yes. Oh, Hoagie, is Art going to sell me some?
I don't think that's, you know, I think we get the idea. Okay, thanks. Okay, let's move on. Jason, you're on the air. If I can get Jason to pop up here. There you are. Jason, you're on the air.
Hi, Richard.
Morning.
How's it going?
Well, it goes up and down, and sometimes it goes in and out, and sometimes you can't even hear it at all. So,
well, it's great. It's great to hear that you're on the radio still.
We're still here, and look, regardless of what happens, and I really want this to work for Dark Matter, and again, that goes back to subscriptions, back to memberships in Club 19.5. If at the end of this next 30 days we can't make it work, we will move it to where it can work, because I'm not going to let the show die. That's one thing you've all demonstrated, that this is valuable. And if it's valuable to you, it's definitely valuable to me, because that was the whole point in the beginning, was to see if we could create something that had value for an audience at large. And you've demonstrated overwhelmingly that you like what you're hearing.
Absolutely. It's a radio show that is at the top of my list, that's for sure.
Well, thank you.
Hey, I got a a couple of questions for you. When I invited you to Utah, you and I had a conversation about Manly Hall's widow, Marie Bauer Hall, and that she had participated in some sort of, I don't know if it was a theatrical ritual or something where she played the part of Isis. Could you expand on that a little bit?
You know, the guy that could is the guy that I'm trying to come on to talk about Kubrick in the next day or so.
I know.
Send me an email on that, because I don't want to forget the question. And if you don't send me an email, I will forget the question, because there's so much else going on that I kind of have to focus on. But he was much more conversant with some of the people that were around Manly Hall and that whole operation than I am. The other possible person that I might bring on to talk about this is Georgia Lambert. Remember Georgia Lambert?
Yeah. And she's the one that had been on the SS United States.
Yes, briefly. And when she was, I think, 17? An ingenue at 17. So, yeah, let me ask Georgia about that, because she would know a great deal more than I do, because what I know is only secondhand, and as you know, I try to go to firsthand sources as much as we can here.
Right. Okay, and then my other question is, well, this is a subject I brought on the old Go-To Talk forum that we had over at Enterprise, and has to do with the Eisenhower White House bringing up, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, bringing up the subject of Phobos being an artificial set. Now, remember, it was Shklovsky, actually, who initially published something on that. I think it was, let's see if I can find it here real quick. Yeah, he wrote something called Artificial Satellites of Mars and Riddle of the Martian Satellites, Moscow, 1959. And it was republished in English, I guess. And it says here, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, 18th of May, 1962. But anyway.
Well, you know, he also published a book with Sagan called Intelligent Life in the Universe, and Shklovsky was the co-author.
Yes. I was just going there.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, if you read in there, in that particular book, he and Sagan are contextualizing the entire sort of model, the bare bones, shall we say, of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, if folks want to go to enterprisemission.com, and I rarely am able to do this because it rarely comes up, but if you go to othersideofmidnight.com, and you scroll all the way to the bottom of that homepage, othersideofmidnight.com, scroll all the way to the bottom, there is a banner, a link at the bottom for Enterprise Mission. You click on Enterprise Mission, and you go over and you look on the homepage, on the index page, just scroll down for a two-parter on Phobos called For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky. And I describe the Shklovsky observations, the American astronomer Douglas Sharpless, who kind of confirmed the Shklovsky observations, Shklovsky's idea that Phobos might be an artificial satellite because of its weird motions around Mars. This is back in the 50s and 60s when there were no spacecraft and they were just looking from Earth with telescopes and taking photographs and marking positions very accurately. And then Sagan's speculations in Intelligent Life in the Universe on Shklovsky. Then we fast-forward the film to the 1980s when the Russians sent, you know, the Soviets sent two spacecraft, Phobos 1 and 2, and some of the new data from the Phobos missions that suddenly got cut off in terms of is Phobos artificial. And finally, our analysis of the NASA and the European Space Agency imagery, which to me says that Phobos is an ancient satellite. It's one of two. Deimos is the other one. They were put into orbit by an advanced civilization. Shklovsky was right. And again, if the world is building toward disclosure, keep in mind what happened between the U.S. and the USSR/the Russians when the Russians tried to send a mission to Phobos a couple, 3 years ago.
Yeah, now that's kind of weird.
And it never got out of Earth orbit because the Russians claimed it was sabotaged.
I don't know.
There was a Russian general came right on a TASS or RT or whatever and said the Americans sabotaged our mission. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but I do find it interesting that because the Russians don't have an active Mars mission, they will now be part of another disclosure discussion vis-a-vis what the Americans have found on Mars, at Ceres, and at Pluto.
Now, that was around the time when that occurred. They also had an IR image of Mars, too, that is a lot like, you know, the Themis material. Remember
yeah,
that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The Phobos, one of the Phobos missions had a camera. I forget the name of the camera, but it took infrared thermal imagery. And when the British Science Museum did a display with the Russians, with the Soviet scientists on the Phobos 2 mission, some of the imagery taken with that camera, which can see underneath the dirt, it can see the temperature differentials underneath the dirt, uh-huh. they looked incredibly geometric. They looked like city.
Absolutely.
A city under the sands.
Sure, the infrared was contiguous with the surface.
Yep.
Well, the other thing I wanted to just mention in the context of Sagan, what he was saying in that Shklovsky and his book, you know, The Life in the Universe.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of things that are pretty intriguing here. What he said, and I got him right here. If the asteroids are a shattered planet, we may wonder if some previous technical civilization blew its world apart. We may point out that the destruction of a planet by a technical civilization requires a state of advance, if that is the word, far beyond our present capabilities. So he's saying basically here, some hundreds of millions of years ago, if a Martian civilization was advanced enough to launch 10 million ton satellites, of course they wouldn't launch them, they'd probably just build them in orbit.
Yep.
Then their works on the planet must have been mighty indeed. Isn't that interesting? In other words, he's foreshadowing what would happen another decade. Because didn't that book originally come out in 1966?
That's right.
Isn't that interesting?
Now, is it because he was just brilliant? We're talking Sagan now. Or did he have an inside track? Remember, in this time frame, 59-60, the Brookings report came out. And what did Brookings say?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was right around that time when Fred Singer published that article in Astronautics in 1960.
Fred Singer was the planetary scientist, geologist, who was an advisor to the Eisenhower administration, looking at the idea of Phobos and Deimos as artificial bodies, a la Shklovsky and Sagan, and then looking at them as bases if we ever went to Mars. And, of course, that would be so cool because we could go to Mars tomorrow with the technology, in essence, that we use to land on the moon. Not quite, but we learned another few things along the way that in the last 50 years since we went to the moon, we could put a mission in, not on Mars itself, not down on Mars. That's too expensive, too complicated, too dangerous. But we could rendezvous with Phobos. We could put a human base on Phobos, live there for a few months, then get back on our ships, come back home, and bring all kinds of astonishing artifacts and relics and maybe library crystals from the folks that left whatever it is on Phobos waiting for us to come and find it.
It was probably Thornton Page that told Sagan to keep his mouth shut.
That's not a bad idea. Yes, I think so.
Now, he was the one that actually...
I'll tell you what, Jason, we're at the quarter after the hour. I think we need to give some people a chance. I know we could talk like this all night. We will. We will.
All right.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, you're on the air. Who are you and where are you calling from?
Well, this is John calling you again from currently in Kentucky. I'm driving my semi, taking a break.
Aha. Uh-huh.
I'm the guy that you asked to send you the links on the USS Enterprise.
Yes, and I thank you for those. Yeah, it looks like we were a day late and a dollar short on that, unfortunately.
You know, who knows? Maybe we'll get a chance at the minutes, because I guess it's next on the chopping block.
Maybe.
Did you get the link also on Dr. Fowler?
Raymond Fowler?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I've known Raymond distantly for years and years. And you're right, I should have him. I don't know what his health condition is, so I have to do a little exploration to see if he could be available. But if he is, I'd love to talk to him because he did one of the most thorough and interesting investigations of a, what was it, Heine called them, close encounter of the fourth kind, when there's an actual physical interaction between someone and a human being.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Raymond Fowler's on the list.
I read his book, The Watchers, many, many years ago.
Oh, many, many years ago. And then remember the Betty Andreasen affair?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember what Betty said she saw when the ETs took her to some place?
So many years ago that I read that.
She was talking about being driven through some kind of, on a monorail or some kind of high-tech device through a city. and there were pyramids, and on the top of them, on one in particular, there was an effigy. And I'm just remembering it now that apparently it was similar to whatever was on top of the Kendor tetrahedron pyramid, which has been partially unburied, having been buried in the Kendor Chasma Canyon on Mars. And there's something at the top. There's a missing statuary that Keith's imaging enhancements have zoomed in on. And Andrew Curry, who's one of our resident artists on all this, has produced some sketches. And it just occurred to me, I just flashed on the idea that Betty Andreasen, in her debriefings by Raymond Fowler decades ago, talked about being in a city where there were pyramids and effigies on top, just like what Keith thinks he's seeing at the apex of the Kendor tetrahedron.
Well, that opens up a whole new line of possibilities.
Doesn't it?
Perhaps, I don't know, I mean, who's to say what's possible and what's not? What if these abducting aliens were able to actually travel back in time to where that was actually an active place? And that's where she went. Who knows?
Who knows?
Another thing, is it okay to discuss Art Bell's situation?
Well, sure, to the extent that we know Art Bell's situation. It seems to be changing kind of by the hour, so I'm not sure how much we know.
No, this whole thing, you know, that I read the story on his little website there. You know, the part that bothers me the most is, you know, this person doing what they did. God, that's, I mean, for them to see the results of what they did, that's not something that's going to encourage a person to say, woo-hoo, I did what I wanted, now I'm done. To me, it's more like the kind of thing, woo-hoo, look what I did, now let's see what I can do.
And well, we know with that kind of psychology that if you give in to them, if it shows that they're having an effect, all you do is encourage them. I mean, obviously, whoever this is a deranged person who thinks he can, you know, stalk Art with a gun, fire at him, what? We're talking, what, 5-6 shots now, if you're keeping track? And no one's been able to catch this guy in a small town like Pahrump?
Yeah, I've driven through Pahrump a number of times back when I was hauling nuclear waste for Bechtel, taking it out there to the Mercury place.
Well, it just shows you how overly spring-loaded we are in an era of terrorism as you know, conversation, to react to even small events because, you know, on a human scale, a small event could be a catastrophic event. The fact that the First Amendment can be so easily interrupted, I find appalling. Absolutely appalling.
And, you know, there's nothing saying that, like I say, the guy got to intimidate Art. Art came off the air, you know, for the obvious reasons of, you know, protecting his family. But just because you leave the air, that's not saying that that's going to meet the guy's criteria. He may just keep right on going.
Well, I've had stalkers. I've had people threaten me. And, you know, the fact that I'm not on the air, I don't feel safer at all. I mean, you have to be vigilant. Once you've been a public person, once you have kind of put your markers down and delineated areas of your position versus others, there are people out there, particularly these days, remember the physics, the good are getting better and the bad are getting a lot worse. And a lot of destabilized people, I think, are coming out of the woodwork that normally would not have done, you know, or ventured to do some of these things because, A, there's a tremendous amplifier in the media. You know, something happens and everybody's writing about it and talking about it and blogging about it and calling into radio shows about it. So there's this vicarious, you know, I'm famous because I can make a lot of trouble. And then there's the other problem, which is that, you know, the physics is destabilizing more people who in other eras would have just, you know, remained in their own kind of isolated bubble, in their own tortured thoughts or whatever hell that they live in here on Earth. Now they have social media, they have other people that are looking, that are responding. So there's more and more encouragement for deranged people to do deranged things, and it doesn't make it safe for those of us that have to make a living sitting behind microphones.
No, it certainly doesn't. I would love to have had the hope that Art might relocate to his far away other homestead and maybe just pick up the show there.
Look, anything is possible. The fact that Keith now says he's going to try to keep dark matter going is encouraging. It's positive. It would be nice. It'd be really nice if Art were to return. I'm not sure that he feels safe enough to do that for quite a while, just because this is an unknown. We don't know who this is. We don't know how persistent. The fact that there were phone calls, plus people actually doing, you know, dastardly stuff in his own yard. It's obviously a very serious decision.
Right. I hear you. You know, the whole thing, you know, the guy's making phone calls and getting through to him. I've tried for 20 years. I can't go get in on his show to save my life.
Obviously, you need a better set of phone calls.
I don't know. I used the fastest rapid dialer thing I could, you know, find on my phone, and I just dial. I never get through, ever.
Oh, well. Speaking of getting through, we've got other people stacked up, so if there's nothing more.
Oh, that'll be it for tonight.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling, and we'll definitely talk again.
Absolutely. Talk to you later, Richard.
Night.
Hey, Richard.
Yes, Scott.
I miss the kinder, gentler days of radio when the worst thing you had to worry about being bothered with were groupies.
Yes. Although, remember Joe Pine?
Oh, yes.
Joe Pine got pretty heated. Okay, we've got Patrick on the air. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Richard.
And what's up in your interesting part of the country? You're calling from Georgia, right?
Yes, I am.
Ah, I
Southwest
knew there was a
Georgia.
Georgia, yes. Georgia on my mind.
I wanted to make two brief comments and a passionate plea to for the show.
Okay.
There was a caller earlier talking about Christopher Noel. No, I'm sorry. A caller calling earlier about the Georgia Guidestones and R.C. Christian. Can you hold on 1 minute, Richard? Let me shut down my.
You've got to turn off devices because the time lag will totally fry your brain. It's a secret weapon we have in radio for guests that we don't or callers we don't really like. We just turn up the background and it drives the. I actually had to do a whole interview with what was the guy's name? Lou Friedman on CNN by satellite with this infernal several second delay. It was the most nerve wracking. Because there was no way I could reach the control room. There's no way I could tell anybody I'm getting this bizarre echo in my head. So I had to really focus on Lou. And then everything we said was repeated. Like several seconds later, it drove me nuts. And I only had to do it for like 3 or 4 minutes.
It was just crazy. I just had to shut down my tune in because I was getting both feeds.
That's what will happen.
That was crazy. But okay. R.C. Christian was the guy that commissioned those Georgia Guidestones.
Right.
And folks have some folks think that might have been something to do with the Rosicrucians.
Hmm.
And I'll just let people study that on their own.
I thought we had some data as to who R.C. Christian finally was associated with, who he was representing.
Yeah, I think it was the Rosicrucians.
Okay.
Go ahead. Last night's show with Christopher Knowles was amazing.
Isn't he a great guy?
Oh, Jack Kirby was a great guy.
Well, Jack Kirby was phenomenal. What did Kirby know, and how did he know it?
Well, let me just run down some things I've written down here. Face on Mars, catastrophe, nuclear-armed airplane crashes into skyscape. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Space shuttle explodes, astronauts identified as challengers, and OMAC, one-man army, which is it's equated to Saddam Hussein. And the thing that was so funny is along that time, the Army recruitment commercials were Army of One.
Hmm.
Isn't that funny?
Well, it's like, what was Kirby tapped into? Chris and I have been looking at this for years, Chris more so than me, because Chris, I mean, that's what he lives, eats, and breathes, is, you know, the comics and the movie tentpole derivatives and all that. But Kirby is this amazing guy that was so quiet, so self-effacing. He was your, you know, back before the term nerd was invented, Kirby was a nerd. But look at the incredible imagination or the window to all kinds of alternate realities that flowed into the comics and into these films now through the magic pen of Jack Kirby.
Not just the movies, but in, you know, in real life here. I mean, what did he know? How did he know that? The Marduk and the looting of the people's treasure, mm-hmm. mankind's treasure,
mm-hmm.
the Stargate. I was thinking along the lines of the Norway spiral that we saw there. Wow. I was simply amazed. It was a replay, guys, from November 26th. If you want to go back and listen and look at those pictures, it's absolutely fascinating because it just relates to everything that we've seen in the last 20 years.
Yeah, this is the show that we ran again last night, so you can just go to last night and actually click on the archive and listen to it and go through the images. But yes, see, what I'm trying to do with this thread in terms of our conversation is to lay foundation that the world that we're living in, the so-called real world, is filled with these subliminal messages going back and forth between other parts of the network, you know, the elites, the government people, the agencies, the non-commissioned, what do they call them? Not non-coms, but non NGOs, non-government agencies. All of these groups have voices, and all of them have constituencies. And it looks to me that the mainstream media now are doing astonishing things with coding information to fit all these invisible hidden audiences that we, as the main audience, are not supposed to know exist.
I agree. And that's where you come in. You simplify it for us. You point it out. You give us the structure to look for, and it's so easy to find it. And that brings me to my passionate plea about your show. Keith, please move Richard to the 9 o'clock spot. It's still 12 Eastern. It's still the other side of midnight regardless. And I've looked at your website, and it looks like if you would maybe drop the stream in Club 19.5 and reduce the sound quality for the MP3s for the downloads and just allow people to download it, you'd save a ton of bandwidth on that side. And, geez, I'd be willing to pay $7 easy for your show because, Richard, you are on to something huge here.
Well, I'm very glad for the support, and anything that will help make this work, I'm for. And again, the guy to have the conversation with is Keith, because we don't control when we appear.
Okay.
And I thank you so much.
I love you, Richard. Hey, Scott. Hey, everybody out there on the other side. Good night, everybody.
Good night, Pat. Okay, we are at the bottom of the hour, and that means tonight I can actually play some music. The best of Amanda Best. Here's one of her tunes that I haven't played in quite a while. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. It's open hailing frequencies tonight, everyone. We shall return.
Yeah. And there you were in front of me. Couldn't see it. What I needed was the only thing you believed in. Living high on a one-way street. What can I get? How much will it be?
The Other Side of Midnight is a new expedition into matters of scientific relevance. We explore the impact galactic revelations might have on both our societies and psyches. Join host Richard C. Hoagland as he takes you on a journey through the minds of scientific experts, investigators, entertainers, and analysts. Other Side of Midnight airs live for free Monday through Friday from midnight to 2 a.m. Pacific. For only $5 a month, listen to the show anytime. Join Club 19.5 to access our full show library of on-demand archives. Go to othersideofmidnight.com and click on the Club 19.5 logo to join today. The Other Side of Midnight, contrasting our own science fiction dreams with reality in this what we call the human experience.
And we are back on the other side of midnight, and you were on the air. Where are you calling from?
Hi there, Mr. Hoagland.
Morning.
I'm calling from Oklahoma.
Ah, Oklahoma. Land of oil wells and fracking earthquakes.
Yes. First, I want to say that I'm a huge Bell Gab person, and that there's a whole slew of people over there who support you 100%.
Well, that's nice to hear.
And I would say that a few callers ago, you had Jimmy on the line, and he said he wanted to move you over to the 9 o'clock slot. And I would say to extend that even further and just have you for like an entire 5 hours.
Oh, give me a break. That would not work for a whole bunch of reasons. That would not work.
It would be amazing. You know, nobody wants Golden Nori over there, right? I mean,
well, look, I have not heard Heather. I don't know how good she is or how bad she is. I know she's been a hell of a producer. That Art has gotten some excellent guests because Heather knows how to be a producer. But again, you know, switching sides of the mic. You know, for years and years, people said, oh, you ought to have your own show. And I resisted because I know how different it is to be on this side compared to that side. And it's not easy. We try to make it look easy, but it's not easy. So, again, there's an awful lot of listeners to this show. There's an awful lot of disappointed listeners to Art show. I think we appeal to a lot of those people. But, again, they have jobs and they can't stay up. And, you know, that it, to me, the most logical thing would be to try the 9 o'clock slot. But, again, it's up to Keith.
Of course. But, you know, that five-hour thing is, you know, totally up to you.
Yeah, thank you. Anything else?
That's about it.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Call again.
You too.
Okay, let's put JN is calling, and I don't know where he's calling from.
Hi, this is Jeremy from Aransas. How you doing, Mr. Hoagland?
Hi, Jeremy. Doing fine. Modulate your mic a little bit. You're a little hot, a little loud.
Oh, okay. I can fix that. Is that a little bit better there?
Yeah, you don't have to yell. Remember, we're having this intimate conversation around the desk here in my office, except you happen to be a few thousand miles away.
Yeah, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, hopefully I'm turned down a little bit.
Oh, much
but
better.
It sure is. Oh, great. Well, it's just great to get on with you. I've talked with you before. I just wanted to get on tonight. I don't want to take a lot of time. I want to give other people a chance to get on. I mainly just wanted to say I hope that hope everything gets better, and I hope that we manage to somehow stay on. And like you said, time will tell. So everything I'll do on my side is do a lot of praying. And like I said, it's good to see that you guys are still trying to go on and play on.
Well, mainly it's because of you guys. I mean, you know, I could do something else. I've got tons of things. I've got, you know, books I want to write. I have this Opus Magnus now that NASA's coming clean and showing us all this amazing data. I have a lot more I'd like to put on paper and arrows and circles on the back and show where the ruins are and kind of build the big picture. But I'm, you know, this show and this audience has grabbed me because there's obviously a lot of interest on the part of people in radio land all over the world for things that synthesize, for bringing pieces of data together that normally might not get brought together and try to look at them as larger than the sum of the parts and try to make sense. So that's what we try to do here. It would be easier at 9 o'clock Pacific, but we can do it here. And again, it's really totally dependent on the number of people who support us. Because until we get significant numbers, commercials are not, you know, really practical. And so the simplest way is for the price of a Starbucks coffee. Once a month, one Starbucks coffee, you can have unlimited access to the archive. And again, you can listen to these shows in a sequence that makes them make sense because there are threads, there are story arcs, there are narratives that I'm quietly trying to build by inviting certain people on in certain sequences so that we get a beginning, middle, and end of the story and we get a greater understanding of where it is we are going.
Well, and you know, and that's the other thing, like the guy pointed out earlier, you know, y'all give your people time to talk and everything and you don't rush them off the phone. And I think a lot of that, it shows how much you love the people. And it's really good when you have these open lines. I like hearing the other people, what they've got to say too. And don't get me wrong. I like the guests too. The guests are great, but each of them has their own, little cup of honey that makes it good for everybody. And I just appreciate everything that y'all are doing. And it is worth that cup of coffee, by all means.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
And thank you so much. I'm going to let you go. And thanks a lot. And I hope to keep you on.
Okay. Thanks. Nightman. Okay. Got a lull here. For anybody who doesn't know, our numbers are 505-796-8802 and Enterprise Mission. And here's another caller, just when I think I can take a sip of water. Okay. Good morning. You're on the air. Where are you calling from?
Hey, Richard. This is your buddy Matt from Denver, but I'm currently in Iowa.
What are you doing?
I haven't called in a couple of months.
Now, don't tell me you're running for president. Come on, Matt. The field is a little crowded.
I am not running for president.
Okay, so what are you doing in Iowa?
I'm not. I'm actually here helping some family out. But, you know, you and I have had some great talks about the presidential candidates.
Let me ask you a serious question. If you're in Iowa, where is the nearest candidate event to you, like tomorrow or the next day? How long are you going to be there?
I'm going to be here for the next few weeks. I actually saw Bernie Sanders on Saturday in Waterloo.
Okay.
He was at the Waterloo West High School.
Okay, here's what you can do as a voter in Iowa, as an American, as a citizen. Find candidates, particularly Cruz is important because he's head of the NASA Space Committee, or Bernie or Hillary. Hillary, of course, because she's leading at the moment. Bernie, because he's the important revolutionary on that side. And if you get a chance to talk to Trump, by all means, don't miss that one. And ask these guys what they think of the stunning stuff on Pluto. Just ask them right out of the blue, have you seen these pictures? Do you understand what's on the pictures? And when you're a president, what are you going to do about it? And see what happens.
Well, I don't think they're going to disclose. I don't think they're going to disclose.
But see, if you don't ask the question in public, nothing will happen.
Well, I hear you on that.
You're in a key place. You could literally get a question on national television just like that on this, just by showing up.
I know, and I tend to show up, even for candidates I don't like.
Absolutely.
Because it's always kind of nice to kind of see your enemy.
That would be so
you know
cool.
What I mean?
And if you had a friend who could actually record this on, with a cell phone or a smartphone or whatever, we could put the video on the other side of midnight and radio with pictures, and we could make you a star all over the world. For asking the critics. No, I'm serious. These are crucial questions.
I hear you, Richard.
That nobody's asking, and these are the change of civilization questions that somebody's got to start asking. So
I know. And
you're in the catbird seat.
I can go to a couple of these smaller towns that they're going to where it's only like a mere 100,
yes.
Maybe 200 people at max might be there.
The signal to
noise
ratio.
I come here during this election cycle just so I can go ahead and take advantage of things like that.
That is so cool. Okay, so who's your first target?
Well, I tried to get a word in with Bernie, but, I mean, his rally was actually pretty big at Waterloo West High. I mean, they filled that whole entire school. The gymnasium was completely packed full, and I couldn't get a word in edgewise. And they even had a press booth with everybody in there from, like, Rolling Stone. I think I saw Matt Taibbi there.
Okay, from NBC.
Know, it was pretty plumb full. But I might be able to squeak in a word with maybe Marco Rubio or maybe a Ted Cruz.
Cruz is the guy because Cruz is the current head. He's the Senate chairman of the Space and Science Committees in the United States Senate. Cruz has a very important job besides being a senator and besides running for president. So if you could ask Cruz the question on Pluto or Mars or anything about the NASA data, which as the chairman of the committee – he should A, know about, or B, want to know about if a duly, registered citizen in front of him, as he's running for president, is asking him to basically address an issue that he's completely unaware of.
Oh, I hear you, Richard. And I had a similar moment with that when I asked, he was one of the peak people that Barack Obama would have had for his head of agricultural. He was a senator in Colorado. Can't remember his name quite off the top of my head, but I met him in Greeley, Colorado.
Okay.
And I asked him his reasoning for voting for the bailout, and it looked like he was waiting for the whole gotcha cameras to pop out, and he flat out told me that the reason that he did it was because he had the biggest experts in the world going ahead and telling him to go ahead and do that. And I said, even though that your constituents didn't want you to vote for something like that, you still went with the guys who told you there'd be lions out in Central Park and it'd be complete anarchy and we'd all be killing each other. He's like, yeah, we went with those guys.
So,
I mean, Richard? I've been trying to get into some of these things just to kind of get in, but I'll go ahead and I'll forward that. I'll ask him what do they think about the images on Pluto. Why not?
Why not?
I mean,
What's the worst that will happen? Someone will basically shine a lot of flashbulbs in your face, and it'll go viral. And other people who are in Iowa.
I'll do it. I'll do it. I'll ask anybody.
Fantastic. Scott, you had something you wanted to ask?
Yeah, was that Senator Michael Bennett?
Yes. No, it wasn't Bennett. It was he's in the district in Denver where I used to live, and then I moved out of his district. No, not Michael Bennett. I'm trying to remember. I think he was the head of agriculture for President Barack Obama for, it would have been his first term.
Oh, was he the guy that wore the hats? He always wore the Western.
Yeah, he always wore like a cowboy hat.
Yeah. I can't think of his name. Can't think
of his
name. You
know who I'm talking about? I can't remember his name, too.
Yeah, I can see him. I can see him, but I can't think of his name.
I can't think of him for the save of life of me, but he was, you know, he was a puppet anyway, so
who
cares?
Was it Salazar?
Salazar. Yeah, that's who it is.
Yeah, okay.
It was Salazar, yeah.
See, I remember his hat.
Dude.
I would be remiss as producer if I didn't say while you're talking to them about Pluto images, these candidates love free airtime, and our door, I'm sure, would be always open to offer them any chunk of 2 hours worth that they're up for.
Now, that's an idea. Matt, did you hear that?
I heard that.
Okay.
Do you want me to go ahead and offer it to
Absolutely.
Them?
You are hereby deputized. You're hereby deputized on the other side of midnight to represent the show, to ask them if they will come on and be a guest.
And let their
people... I will go ahead and do it.
I mean, I would love to talk to Rand Paul. I've got so many questions. Dr. Bookman promised me he was going to try to get me to Rand Paul. Remember, he's our kind of libertarian on the conversation panel here.
Yeah, he's the diet version of his father, though, for when it comes to...
Well, but
the policies of libertarianism.
But he's the one that's running. Wouldn't it be interesting to get him
so he
could actually have a conversation with a bunch of us and we could ask him serious questions? Because he's got a. It's interesting tonight that you had the candidates, four of them, against World War III, and then you had the mainstream, you know, candidates apparently are for World War III, leading with Chris Christie. I mean, what is he thinking? He wants to shoot down Russian jets. Is he out of his mind?
Well, I think he probably is, Richard. I mean, it's pretty clear. I mean, why would you want to get involved with a superpower with that many nuclear arms?
Well,
or that many people.
Duh.
That they could go ahead and just have an, you know what I mean? Just they could line up people against our allies, and we couldn't stop it. They have too many people with guns there. Like, we couldn't stop those amount of people.
Even at the height of the Cold
War. Serious harm to the planet.
Even at the height of the Cold War, when Ronald Reagan was calling the Soviet Union the evil empire, there were quiet orders given, do not make provocative motions. Don't, you know, when these guys play chicken, when the boomers, you know, the Russian subs would come within, you know, a few feet of our boomers and all that. There was this whole kind of background sub-Rosa war that could have broken out into a hot war, a thermonuclear war at any instant, and to have survived all that, and then you have a guy like Governor Christie say, oh, I'll shoot down the Russians. I mean, give me a break. Does he want to follow the lessons of the president of Turkey, who apparently is in bed with ISIS, who apparently wants to start the end of the world, and that's the way it would happen? That is so.
Yeah, we don't need to get in a peeing war with anybody.
No. And see, what no one seems to understand is that behind the scenes, diplomacy is actually making a very good showing. This deal with the Iranians. Some night I should have someone come on to kind of go through why we're so much safer now that we've got a deal with the Iranians, where everybody is looking and monitoring, and you know, you get our guys in there, and the next thing you know, we've got viruses that can monitor everything they're doing all throughout the government under the rules of the engagement of inspectors and all that as part of the treaty verification. So the more we know, the better. The less we know, the worse. And some of these guys want to simply cut us off from any information and go right to the button. Remember Senator Cruz the other day?
You're absolutely right. And that's why I don't agree with Rand Paul. Rand Paul wanted to go ahead and make us isolationists from Iran. But even his father said that Barack Obama made the right choice by doing the deal that he did, because at least this way, like, everything is more neutral ground. Like, we can actually have diplomacy, and maybe people might be able to view us as better human beings, so they want to emulate us and not want to rise up and against us and join their government that, you know what I mean, might not be the best for them. I think that this is like the best way. Show yourself in a positive light. They might want to try to be like us.
Well, what's the worst that can happen? Again, you know, we're looking at the most monitored treaty in history. It's not technically a treaty. I shouldn't call it that. It's an executive agreement between this administration and the Iranians. It has other permutations for the next administration because there are limitations when you do international agreements on each administration. But the fact is we're not going to be going to a nuclear war with Iran unless they do something really dumb and stupid like try to build a bomb with everybody looking, which they're not. I don't think they are into committing suicide.
They don't have... No, they don't have the enriched enough plutonium to even
and now
that
we have a tracking
manner in the next 20 years.
And now as part of the treaty, we have a tracking mechanism on from the mines all the way to the refinement and distillation of the right isotopes. And that's unprecedented, again, in any of these international agreements. So we're quietly winning on the keep us from World War III side. Why do we need precipitous voices like Christie this morning saying, oh, I'd shoot down a Russian jet. Of course I would.
It's so silly.
All right.
But people, you know, they like that. But, hey, Richard, can I just go ahead and just say a couple of quick things for you? I really hope you get Art's spot. Like, you're perfect for it. I love the show. And I wish you nothing but the best. You've always put on a good show. And I'd like to give a shout-out to the DM Talk hashtag on Twitter, and I'd like to go ahead and tell them that, yes, indeed, I am Art Bell's undefeated atheist, as well as Matt from Denver from Richard C. Hoagland, so I go ahead and endorse you for that spot, buddy.
Thanks, Matt.
No problem.
Take
Later.
Care. Take care. Okay, Trey, we got only a few minutes left. What's up?
Hey, Richard, I was just wondering if you think Gene Roddenberry would be rolling over in his grave at what Star Trek's becoming.
I don't know what Abrams is going to do with the next one. I think the idea of a restart and a parallel universe and all that is de rigueur. I like exploring new things. Remember, part of our gestalt in what's going on is that we are, in fact, looking at the leakage of other realities, other dimensions, parallel universes into our reality. How else could you explain this amazing political season, and it hasn't even begun? It's pretty out there. But no, I don't think Gene would be spinning in his grave. I think he would want to bring some of the foundational material that he brought to Star Trek and remind us that we're on the threshold of becoming something like the Federation if we get it off on the right foot, if we launch it correctly. I think today Musk had a test of his Falcon 9. In a couple, 3 days, he's going to try to recover the first stage of the Falcon 9 back at Cape Canaveral. I may have an appropriate guest to have on that night to assess his plans if he makes it. And I think technologically that he's going to make it this time. I just have that feeling. And that will open a whole new doorway to the democratization of the solar system and getting us out there to see what's really out there, so we no longer have to wait for governments to decide ultimately someday to tell us the truth.
You really need Musk on.
Say again?
Yeah, I said you really need to get Musk on.
Yeah, and I'm pursuing. I mean, I had some doorways that were opened and now have closed, and I'm looking for other doorways. So if anybody out there has a direct route to Elon Musk, I'd love to have him on. If we go to 9 o'clock, it would be easier because an awful lot of these people. I mean, on the West Coast, that'd be a piece of cake for 9 o'clock. Even midnight is not bad, but it's the East Coast where the time is really killing us because an awful lot of interesting people that are willing to talk to us, they take one look at the clock and they say, I don't think so.
Yeah, it's killing me. It's like 5 in the morning here.
But you're up.
Hey, would you give us a chair squeak on the way out for bingo?
A chair squeak.
Just a little squeak of the chair for old time's sake.
We can do that.
Thank you so much, Richard, and I hope you get 9. That's where you belong.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
You too. Okay, we got a few minutes left. It's 2:52.
If Matt is listening, Matt.
Matt in Denver?
Yeah, Matt in Denver. Just have any candidate or their people, have them contact producer@othersideofmidnight.com, and we'll take it from there.
Well, we were having a conversation with some of Bernie's people, and I never kind of found out where that went. That was a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, we're still working on that.
Okay. I mean, given the fact that there are, what, 15 on the Republican side and there's 3, maybe 4 on the Democratic side, you would think that all avenues to you know, airwaves, to audiences, to voters would be looked at carefully. And I certainly would not object to talking to some of these candidates. Can you imagine what I could ask Senator Cruz?
Well, and last night, I don't know how much of the debate you saw, but I was sitting here agog thinking, ask substantive questions, Wolf and the white-haired guy, Anderson Cooper.
Don Hewitt?
No. And I'm thinking, why are they dwelling on this war madness?
Because frankly, Scott, I think it brought out a very important rift in the Republican side, which is very good news. The fact that we've got 4 candidates who foursquare understand that we are at the precipice where we could literally kill civilization. And then we've got 5 candidates, so-called establishment guys, who want to go gung-ho, you know, Buck Rogers and Hopalong Cassidy and the Lone Ranger all combined into one and shoot down Russian jets. Give me a break.
Madness. I just shook my head. But, yeah, you would ask the questions that need asking. They would give them the opportunity and you'd give them the space to answer without a lot of nonsense in between.
It would be a lot of fun. And as I said, I have particular questions I'd like to ask some of the candidates. But anybody who wants to show up in front of these microphones, and again, we can do it from anywhere in the world. The technology now, we demonstrated with my friend Keith Morgan when we did the Pluto special. He literally had a wired headset, and he would take it off, and he would plunk it on the unsuspecting guest. And bingo, they were on the air all over the world with us able to ask questions. The same thing can happen at these candidate rallies. If any of you folks out there really want to get somebody on the air to give them an hour or 2 hours to where we could ask unfettered questions, and obviously we would bring you in to ask important questions, we might learn a lot in a very brief period of time that you're not going to learn through the regular campaign process where it's all basically, what's the new buzzword now? Oh, yes, politically correct. Okay, we've got 3 or 4 minutes to the end of the hour. Time for a couple of calls if you guys want to slide in here with something on a Wednesday morning. Crystal clear and cold. The temperature is now 20 degrees here in the Land of Enchantment. And it's there's no moon up there tonight. The moon is very close to the sun, so it's dark, sparkling stars, but very dark. So in the last few minutes of this show, let me just reiterate where we stand. Keith and I are trying to make this work so that this show can you know, reach a larger audience, can become more financially secure, can be more stable in terms of the projected future of the network. And we started here, you know, without Art Bell and Keith putting up with me in the very beginning. We would not be on the radio right now. Fortunately, we've all learned a lot. We've all had a wonderful time and would like to have more wonderful times. But again, if you want to make sure the show continues, please join Club 19.5. I mean, $5, that's a cup of coffee at Starbucks for a month. You get unlimited people calling. Oh, here's one of my favorite people. We actually may be able to bring her in. Good morning, Laura.
Hi.
How are you?
Am I on?
You're on. On the air.
Sorry. You know what I noticed, Richard? There is a delay with the pop-up player versus TuneIn Radio app. And I was wondering how that worked, because when you go to othersideofmidnight.com and you click on Listen Live, it brings you to the Dark Matter Digital website. You have 2 options. Here I go getting all technical again.
I was going to say, you've got 30 seconds, so...
Okay, so... really glad to hear you tonight. Want you in that 9 o'clock time slot. I don't know why Keith responded to me and said it had to be a paranormal show. There's that word again. Doesn't have to be paranormal at 9 o'clock. We need you there.
Do you know that's really encouraging from one sense? Because obviously Keith thinks that our looking at ruins on Pluto is very mainstream and not paranormal at all.
There you go.
We're making progress.
Yeah.
We're making critical progress.
I did have a quick question. You had Joseph Farrell on back in November. Did you guys talk about his theory of how the LEM got off the moon? He was saying it was using an alternative propulsion.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys cover that? I need to go back and listen to that. Club 19.5, people.
Very briefly, and yes, it's there in the archive in Club 19.5. When he comes back on, which will be in a few days, I will definitely talk to him about that because I have independent evidence that, in fact, the propulsion system that lifted the lunar module off the moon when they were coming home was not the kind of rockets that we're thinking of. So, and I'm not hearing anything in my ears, Keith. If you're trying to send me something, it'd be useful right about now. We're at the end of the show. Laura, thank you so much.
Good to hear you, Richard. Can't wait to see what happens and to continue getting to hear you. We need you.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
You too. Night-night. Well, everybody, that's the end of another episode. Tune in tomorrow night. There may or may not be surprises. I'm working on it. And again, until then, remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.